you very quickly just a quick lecture shout out because there's your sort of referenda going on at the moment.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah,
give them a minute. I think there's a few just coming in.
Travellers.
Yeah. Go for it, yeah.
Hi guys, sorry, can I just grab your attention for 2 seconds? As you may or may not be aware, USO are currently holding a referenda. So it's on the USO website, and if you go on, you will need your USO to log on. There's lots of different questions, including should we ban people running as a group? Should USO staff be allowed, should be paid a living wage as opposed to minimum wage? Should our sabbatical officers be able to stand for 2 years? Should we ban Sab Miller, who are an alcohol company? Lots and lots of different varied ones. Please go on, have your opinion. You've got till 6 p.m. tonight to do it on the USO website. Enjoy your lecture.
And the thing I had to remember to do at the start of this lecture, which I forgot to do at the end the other day, is it was saying about getting student reps. Yeah. So there were a couple of people I know that were interested possibly in being student reps. Are they here? Yeah. Okay, so you need, as I said, to elect a student rep for the class. We have at least 2 people interested, but anyone that would be interested in standing as a rep for the class, please raise your hand. That includes the 2 of you that said earlier. Anyone that wants to nominate anyone else to be a rep for the class? Please shout it out if you want to nominate someone else to be a rep for the class. There's a lot of muttering and pointing to pals going on here, but no, any direct nominations? Okay, well, the 2 of you that have said you'd be interested, would you like to stand up and just briefly say why you'd like to be the reps or what you could offer? Or we could just say straight away, we'll just nominate these 2 people and they can both be reps. Yeah, are people happy with that? Well, I think you should at least stand up so people know who you are and just say what degrees you're doing, just so that people know if we've got any, what's to afraid. So you're doing informatics courses as well? Yeah. Okay. So it does sound like between you, you're covering quite a few classes that other people in the course might be taking, which is always a good thing, rather than just having unrepresentative representatives. Okay, so any objections? Fine, you have reps for the class now. If the 2 of you could email me with your details, I'll pass that on to the ITO, and that'll also get passed on to the Student Association as well. So the way this works is, at various times, particularly when we have regular feedback meetings from all the reps, then the reps will be asked to contact you as a class and invite you to give comments to them. However, obviously you can do that at any time. So anything that you want to give feedback directly to us, either myself or Henry or Alyssa or Annette, that's fine. Anything you feel you don't want to give back directly and or you formally want to be passed on and may want, for example, the reps to bring up in the staff student liaison meeting, then mail the reps. So as well as mailing me, you two, can you also email the class just to let them know who you are? Okay, everybody happy with that? Fine, good, done. Okay, so we're going to carry on talking about attention today. Let's turn the lighting down a little bit. I'm going to attempt at some point to run some videos with sound from the PC. Whether that works or not, we will find out. Okay, so particularly what I want to talk about today is attentional selectivity, change blindness, and unconscious transference. At this point, we'll see how the PDF works. Yes, it's working. Okay, so noticing change in the environments. Actually, can I just make sure that we're in the right lecture slide here? Yeah, That's fine. Okay, so as we said in the previous lecture, we're defining attention as the ability to selectively dedicate processing resources to some aspects of the environment while ignoring or filtering out others. So remember, this was the more scientific definition rather than just the straight English dictionary definition, what you tend to work with in every day. So issues here are about selectivity. So visual attention, as we said, could be driven by top-down goals. That is, we are explicitly looking for something, and so we're driving that cognitively from our memory, you know, from down to the stimulus. But it could also be bottom-up, where we go from the stimulus, so we're, you know, we're viewing the environment, there's some signal, something that happens, something that changes that causes us, that as a stimulus, to attract our attention. We say it as attract our attention, and we move our attention to focus on that. So as I said before, it could be top-down or bottom-up. And usually, between them, these mechanisms do allow us to pay attention to the things that are most important for us to see. And generally, that's for basic survival, but also social cues in terms of our social interactions, which obviously are much higher level than just our basic fundamental needs, then mostly they work, but they can be prone to failure under certain circumstances. And when they do fail, it might even be that have been fairly significant changes that you don't notice. So that's the sorts of things we're going to look at a bit here today. And it is the case, even if you're told sometimes that that will happen, you still may not see it. Okay, so there are various things in the environment that we actually see. We see, you know, we have the light, it causes things to fire. We have processing, as we said, later in the visual system. But they're not the focus of attention itself. They're more deeply processed. So it is possible to physically look directly at something and still not be aware of it. Okay, so it's not just about the vision and even the perception. Attention is, you know, doing something additional, different, more here. So what we want to look at is initially the concept of inattentional blindness. This refers to a stimulus not being attended to and not perceived. So this is a case where we might miss things simply because we don't look at them, and if we don't look at them, if we don't attend to them, then we don't perceive them. And remembering that this is about your conscious experience of vision. Now, you may remember in the first lecture, Henry showed you a bit of video. Some of you going like, maybe I remember, maybe you missed it, maybe it was so far ago you don't remember. But anyway, what I'm going to do is just show you the actual original video for that. So you may remember what happens and why, but I'm just going to show you again anyway, just to remind you. And we're going to hope this works and the sound on it. Okay, so this is actually quite a fun web page. It's actually called the Invisible Gorilla. And they have a whole bunch of different tasks that relate to selective attention and some talks about them. So it's worth just having a look at that out of interest. But this is what we're actually focusing on. So the idea here is that the researchers told the participants watching this, your task is you have two teams of players, count how many times the players in white pass the ball. That is your task.
This is a test of selective attention. Count how many times the players wearing white pass the basketball.
Okay, from the
How many passes did you count? The correct answer is 15 passes. But did you see the gorilla?
I think most of you did, because you have already seen this and were cued to do that.
This video is from research by Daniel Simons and Christopher Chabrie and is copyrighted. It is available for use in talks,
so
training, and teaching on DVDs from VizCog Productions.
Covering themselves, so.
Learn more at theinvisiblegorilla.com.
Yeah, so the webpage is quite good and gives you various other examples. So, there, what they found was a lot of people didn't notice the gorilla. Okay, they were focusing on the task and they didn't notice the gorilla. And I don't, you know, in the first lecture where you were shown that, how many of you didn't notice the gorilla? Quite a few of you, yeah. How many of you noticed it this time? Is anyone that didn't notice it last time and forgotten and didn't notice it again this time? No, you were too busy, you were too cued to it. And you had seen it, and you knew exactly what to expect. Okay. Then usually on a replay, people do see it when you cue them to it. Basically, your attention shifts from the task of the counting and the ball passing to looking for the gorilla. Okay. So it's quite often the case that we will come across things quite often, and we just don't see the details. So if I said to you at the moment, okay, for any one of the coins in your pocket, tell me what's on the back of it. Could you tell me? How many people think they could tell me? No? How often are you surprised when you just decide to look at a coin and think, oh, that's interesting, they've put that on there. I just didn't notice that at all. You know, I'm worried about, you know, what size coin it is, how much it's worth, what I'm having to pay for something. But I do not pay attention to actually what's on the coin. To the extent that occasionally I've looked at a coin and gone, is this a forgery? Is this a foreign coin? No, this picture I don't even recognize. And yet I've probably used that coin or a coin of the same design and passed it without thinking, without attending to it. Okay, so repetition alone isn't sufficient for seeing and then internalizing the representation of that. Okay, and that was just the visual reminder there. Okay, so we can talk about both inattentional blindness and change blindness. And change blindness is closely related to intentional blindness. It occurs when our intentional mechanisms fail to alert us to changes in the visual environment. And again, if you think about, you know, how we've, you know, evolution and how we've developed, yes, it's important that we do perceive changes, particularly, you know, if there are predators, we want to notice the predators. We obviously want to not miss the fact that, you know, something is about to attack us. On the other hand, if we are doing that, we're probably not noticing something else. We're not attending to something else. So it will depend also on the context and the types of stimuli, what we may or may not notice. So where we fail to notice changes, this happens quite often in daily life, where we don't have any particular, like, focused, top-down, you know, driven reason to attend to something. Or it may be when there's some stimulus that we just, again, it could be quite low level through motion, color. Generally, the things that capture our attention that cause us to perceive something that we may miss. We do need attention if we want to get, if you have a particular scene, if you want a clear and detailed representation of the scene, then we do need to have attention to that whole scene. And frequently what we're doing is just attending to part of it. Now, it may be, it is often the case that actually we can get the gist of a scene even if we only see it very briefly, but we may not get the details, and particularly we may not get the details that are pertinent to us at that particular point. The text, the vision text, talks a bit more about this. Now, what I want to talk a bit about now is the way in which some people have investigated this phenomena, the fact that you may actually not attend to change that occurs, even though it may appear to be a fairly blatant change in terms of, you know, what you can perceive. So in order to look more at change blindness, they used a particular paradigm called the flicker paradigm. It was developed by people like Rensink and colleagues in 1997. There's readings on it, and you will be looking at it in more detail in the tutorial next week. Okay. So what they were trying to do is they were trying to better understand this phenomena of change blindness, whether it was due to attentional failure, simply that you did not attend to something, or whether in fact it was just because if something was brief in terms of the display, then you might not have seen it because it was just so brief. You know, was it a timing issue or was it an attention issue? They found that what they got participants to do was to look at when they perceived a change. So the idea here is you have two images of a scene that differ in one small feature. There's a change that has been made intentionally in the scene. And what they did was they separated these scenes when they showed them to participants by having, rather than just seeing one scene the next, they put a masking slide in between, i.e. a blank slide. So hence you got more of a perception of it as a flicker rather than a change. They looked to see how quickly participants spotted the change. For example, if one object moves or it disappears or it changes colour, or if you actually change the object. That's the sorts of things they were manipulating in this. And when we come on to talk a bit more about sort of experimental design in the next couple of weeks, we'll talk about this in terms of how you design such an experiment and what things you are manipulating, what things you are keeping steady, what that means in terms of your experimental design. The results they had, they came to the conclusion that actually the change blindness wasn't to do with the brevity of the stimulus. It wasn't because it was too short. It was because there was a failure to pay attention. As I said, we'll look a bit more at that in the tutorial next week. But I'm going to give you the example of, again, another video here. So this is a classic experiment conducted by Simons and Levine, where they were looking at effectively a real-world example of this. If I manage to play
the door study. This video shows a participant from a 1998 study by Daniel Simons and Daniel Levin. Watch what happens as the unsuspecting pedestrian provides directions.
Some of you may be familiar with this.
The young man on the left is one of the experimenters. He has approached the white-haired man and asked for directions. Watch closely as two people carrying a door pass between them, and the first experimenter is replaced by someone else.
Okay, and they just carry on as if they haven't changed.
Like many of the people in this study, the pedestrian was entirely unaware that he was talking to a different person.
Okay.
Approximately 50% of the people approached in this study didn't notice when the person they were talking to was replaced by someone else.
Okay. You're laughing. You might think I would.
This study was among the first to demonstrate that change blindness can occur outside of the laboratory. This video is from research by Daniel Simons and Daniel Levin and is copyrighted. It is a...
Okay. So, do you think you would have spotted it? You probably think you would have, but whether you would have or not is a different matter. Sorry? 50%, yeah, okay. 50% did spot it, but 50% didn't. And as we said, we'll look at that in a bit more detail in the tutorial next week and what other ways they varied it. So for example, they did find they were more likely to spot it if it was a young person and it was a young person that did the change, but less likely if it wasn't the same peer group. So there were other factors that did also influence it as well. Okay, is that the same? I'm just trying to remember if that's the same. Yeah. Okay, so it showed footage of where the participant failed to notice when the person they're talking to changed. As I said, the reason this was really interesting is people had shown these sort of phenomena in the lab, but they hadn't really shown that you could, you know, this also happened in the real world too. Now, obviously, there are cases where you don't want people to notice stuff. So imagine you're watching a movie, and there are many times when movies, continuity errors are made. You know, things change that are not supposed to, because the way they tend to shoot a movie is not from the start to the end. You know, so, oh no, we forgot that person was wearing, you know, a red tie in this scene. We forgot we gave them a different tie. No one will probably notice, and most of the time you don't. You know, if you look at the things like, you know, all the programs that show you movie blunders, a lot of the time you may have watched that movie and you may not have spotted it. It can be really annoying, though, and if it does happen and you do spot it, it's actually quite disruptive. I think in one of the Harry Potter films, one of the early ones, and they're sitting at the table having the feast, and Harry actually swaps sides of the table. And I can remember watching it thinking, like, hang on a minute, he moved. He wasn't there before. And it was really annoying and really distracted me. But most of the time with those things, in fact, I'll probably go back and look at it and find that that didn't happen now, but it's like, it really does have a bigger effect if you do spot it, but most of the time you just don't. And that's a good thing for movies, because it means most of the time they get away with those sorts of errors, because they're usually not intentional. Okay, so anyway, people have used this, what's called the flicker paradigm, in investigating these sort of phenomena. Now, the other thing to tell you just now is that your second assignment will be an essay about the flicker paradigm and looking at papers in relation to it. So to flag you ahead on that, this is something you will be finding more about and finding other examples of. And that assignment should be up on the webpage fairly shortly. Okay? So what the sorts of materials and stimuli people use in this will be, for example, in this case, images of faces. And if I just say, you know, how we've been looking at it for a while now, if I'd actually delayed showing it then, just say, put your hand up when you notice the difference. So how many of you have already spotted the difference? Yeah, pretty much all of you. Some of you may not have actually looked. So the difference is actually in the person in the bottom right-hand corner has changed. So the way the flicker paradigm works step by step is that you see, you have a cycle of showing the images and blank screens in between. So you have the initial image, the changed image, and you have two masking slides as the components with... And it keeps going, and the idea is, as a participant in a study using the flicker paradigm, your task is to say when you notice what the change is. Okay? So what they're measuring is the time from when it starts, how many repetitions before you notice the change. And actually, if you get the change wrong, you keep going till you actually see the change that's actually there. And again, I'm going to give you a couple of examples of this. So I'm going to get you to do it. So when I show you the video, what I want you to do is look for the change, and once you spot the change, just stick your hand up. Okay? So we can see how long it takes you. Now, just to say, what they tend to do here is, rather than showing image A, image B, image A, image B, they tend to do A, A, B, B, or, yes, so the way they say it. It depends. Sometimes they don't, certainly don't do A, 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 B, 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 because if you have a lot and then a small change, it's actually easier to notice. They tend to alternate, and it can either be A, B, A, B, or A, A, B, B, A, A, B, B. Anyway, we're going to give you the first one. So as I said, watch, stick your hand up when you spot the change. Ah, where are we? Okay, a couple of you, a few more. Few more, and the pressure's on. And we're going to keep going till everyone spotted the change. Okay, for anyone that hasn't spotted it yet, still. No, it's still a few people that haven't spotted it yet. I've told you to look for a change and you're still having problems spotting it. So a few aha experiences here. Okay, if I tell you now, it's the guy at the left, his trousers keep changing colour. Right, so there's a few groaners there. And now, if you're watching it, you can see very clearly. But what you've got there is it's actually not just one image to the next. There's actually a blank screen in between that you may not be registering fully, but is actually part of the study design. So the other example, sorry, I have to go through again. One slight flaw in this plan. This is a couple having dinner. And there are more of these. You can go and have a look and play with them. Try them out on your friends and really annoy them. So this is, dinner. Okay, see if you can spot. Okay, someone's got it, somebody got it straight away. I actually found the first one much quicker myself, but a lot of you are finding the second one much quicker. Some of you still not quite there yet? Okay, watch the bar behind them. Okay, what were you focusing on? What were you paying attention to? Not the bar in most cases. So there are issues about how central to the scene the item is that changes. Now in the marketplace, it's the guy's trousers. There are a lot of people in the marketplace. He does happen to be the stall holder, but it's a change in colour, whereas the second one, it was a change in position, but of an object that's less central. So these things also, they investigated the differences between these sorts of things. So the idea is this actually is designed to trick your visual system. No, it is set up to do that in order to explore how these things work and better understand what happens. So it is actually intentionally disrupting the apparent motion cues. I mean, the fact that I said the other day, if you remember, when you're seeing a film, or certainly an older film, what you're actually getting is many, many images, one after the other. You see that as continual motion. But what this is doing is sort of playing with that a bit. So motion's a very effective cause of bottom-up attentional capture. That is, motion is one of the things that will help you perceive a change in your environment, i.e. you are more likely to spot changes that involve motion. But because of the way the Flickr paradigm is designed, it disrupts that by showing you this screen in between. So if you, when we come to discuss the tutorial next week and reading the papers, it talks about why this might be the case. Why does showing a blank screen in between actually disrupt that process? You know, what is it doing to your brain that means that you no longer pay attention to the change that you would normally expect to see? So we've got the apparent motion illusion occurring when you've got two objects separated in space, but also separated by a brief interval in their presentation. That is by throwing up the blank screen in between. So viewers perceive objects as moving from one location to another rather than appearing at each in turn. I mean, this is, you know, the effect you get when you flick through a cartoon with small changes, or is that when you watch a movie? So this is, again, just another example of apparent motion. And in fact, in this one, I'm going to have to paste. Actually, no, I'll leave it. Basically, what it just shows is if you have a ball, an image of a ball here, and then an image of a ball here, and then you keep showing one, then the other, what it looks like is the ball's jumping back and forward. I mean, it's something you'll be familiar with anyway. Okay, if you insert a masking slide between them, you disrupt that. And it disrupts your perception of it as apparent motion. So basically, you're playing with the visual system. You're messing it up such that attention doesn't work in the way it's supposed to. So it may be that what you're actually doing is effectively resetting your representation of the scene each time you do that. That may be one way that it's thought about. Ah, no, it is now. Okay. Okay, so what you've got there is the top ball. It's actually, all you're seeing is alternate images, but what you actually see is the ball moving backwards and forward. And it works even if they're a different colour. Even if it changes colour, you still get the effect of the same object moving back and forth. And this actually, if you go to this web page as well, there's a whole bunch of other fun things to play with. Basically, things that are illusions designed to trick your visual system. But I'm not going to go into them now, but you can go and have a look at them and play with them. Okay, so why is this a particularly useful research tool? So this whole paradigm was, you find this quite often in the way that cognitive psychology works and experimental methods, that people will come up with particular experimental paradigms that allow you to investigate a particular phenomena. You know, and you might wonder, how did they come up with that? Why did they determine that? Sometimes it's they did it by accident. Like we talked about the detecting edge cells. It was the, if you remember in the case, it was the slide moving across the screen that caused a change, and in fact that meant they a whole new paradigm for a way of working. But in this case, this paradigm is very useful. It's a reaction time task. You're looking at the time elapse between the first image and some response, indicating that you've correctly detected a change. It assumes that faster mean detection times for a particular stimulus means that it's giving a greater share of the viewer's attention or resources than competing stimuli. So what tends to happen often is when you're doing these sorts of studies, people measure reaction times on the grounds of things that take you longer to react to usually mean you're having to give more resources to processing. Okay, so cognitively you're having to do more work to process them if it takes you longer to react. That's sort of a general way in which these things work. So an effective way to study what types of stimulus or changes occur are to look at the ones that are more difficult to process. That is those that require more cognitive effort. So the reaction time is taken as an indicator of greater cognitive effort. Also, if you've got various competing stimuli, then it's a good way of testing which ones you actually, for example, in this case, are attending to by looking at the timing. Which ones do you respond quickest to? The flicker paradigm has also been used to study attentional biases. That is how you decide how to share your attention between different stimuli. Okay, so it may be the case that you don't just focus your attention on one object in the environment. There may be several things. And if there are several things, how do you determine how to share between those things? So an easy example is talking on the phone while you're driving. Okay, you're sharing your attention there between two quite different sets of cues in the environment and things. One is auditory, it's listening to what the other person's saying, it's deciding what to say. The other is more visual, it's the environment. And ideally, you certainly want to pay attention to both. I mean, one of the reasons it's illegal to use a hand phone whilst driving is because people are really bad at this. Okay, the research also suggests, though, even if you do it hands-free, your attention to the road is not as good if you are talking on the phone. Okay, so you are actually having to share your attention in a way that's detrimental to the main task, which is the main task of driving. So you may think it's not affecting you, but actually the research suggests it is. It's also the same sort of way as you have the friends that drive, that when you're talking to them, they feel obliged to turn and look at you when you're talking rather than the road. You know, not only then are they really being distracted by the auditory focus, they're actually changing where they're looking so they can't see. And clearly this is going to affect their attention to the external stimuli. You know, and anyone finds an easy way of how to tell them to do not to do that, you know, great. But what you tend to find is you just stop talking to them when they're driving because it just saves you a lot of hassle. But basically, so you've got the idea here is you may have different things that you want to focus on, you know, more than one thing. And how do you share the resources to do that? So the flicker paradigm has been used to explore these sorts of things as well. It could be that there's one of the things you do when you're testing may be intentionally to give people other tasks. So you're trying to see how they attend to particular objects and environment, and you tell them at the same time to count backwards from 100. So you're intentionally giving them an overload and disrupting the task in order to see the impact that has. If you look at some of the studies on attentional bias, so for example, Yaxley and Zwan, they found that if you showed smokers and non-smokers photographs of household objects, smokers were faster to detect changes in smoking-related objects rather than the non-smokers, okay? It maybe means more to them. But they were slower to detect a change in a neutral object if a smoking object was present, i.e. their attention was more drawn towards the smoking, the objects that related to smoking. These weren't actually smoking objects. Sorry, that's a good example of the other part of the course, the language, how we use the language. Okay, so if you have an object related to smoking, And that was what changed. Smokers were better at seeing the change. If you had an object related to smoking and you changed something else, the smokers were worse at seeing the spotting the change. So clearly there are attentional biases here that also relate to other factors and other features in the individual that's processing this. So this is just an example here of the sort of stimuli that may be shown. And again, put your hand up when you see the difference in the pictures. Are you a smoker? Okay, fine. Some of you like straight away. It took me ages. Okay, what it is see the cigarette lighter? It's rotated in one of the pictures. For some of you, you like spotted it straight away. For others, you're going like, what? You know, I didn't even care or notice. You know, even I had to look at it really closely to see that. But the sorts of studies they did, what they found was smokers were quicker to spot that than non-smokers. Okay. And when you had a neutral object and there were no smoking objects present, both groups, similar sorts of reaction times. Okay, I'm sure I would have seen that. Okay, so when I asked you earlier, do you think you would have seen that? Do you think you would have spotted it? And everyone pretty much goes, yeah, I'm sure I would have. Actually, you probably wouldn't have. You know, most people may have confidence that they will see these changes. But in some cases, even when you tell people, they don't spot them. So it's interesting that participants can take a long time to see these changes, if they see them at all, even when you're warned that there is going to be a change. Even if you're given hints about the type of change, it may still be a while before you actually work out what that change is. But almost everyone says, I'm sure I will see a change. It's good. We're optimistic. So they coined the term change blindness to capture how we're not only blind to the change, but blind to our own blindness of the change. Okay, so that's not a typo. That is meant to be blindness to change blindness. So we believe, you know, we see the world, we think we see the world very clearly. So we think that when there are changes, we are going to see them. It's going to make sense. And it is the case that abrupt changes, you know, are usually accompanied by motions, other signals, you know. So we are designed to see change, but there are some changes we don't see. We don't always see change. So our experience suggests that we will, but particularly in these cases, when maybe people are tricking us a bit, particularly, or where it's a slightly unusual circumstance, then maybe we don't. I mean, the good thing is to have a belief about how the world works and to have expectations, to have schemas about what sorts of things you're likely to see in particular circumstances. It helps you function in the world. So when that gets messed with, you may not notice because you've learned to behave that way. You know, and that's actually, on the balance, that's a good thing, but for some particular circumstances, it's not. One of the things that this has led to in terms of research is looking at how this also relates to memory and how this also can relate to what's referred to as a form of unconscious transference. So there's a whole bunch of work, and some of the readings that, particularly from the memory text that we said for you to look at, relate to eyewitness identification. So you have a crime committed, you're an eyewitness. How confident are you that you can recognize that person again later? How confident are you if you're given a lineup of suspects that you will recognize A, if that person is in the lineup, and B, which that person is. Sometimes what happens is something called unconscious transference. If there is possibly, say, an innocent person present at the crime scene, when it occurs, i.e. not the perpetrator of the crime, they may get incorrectly identified as the perpetrator. So they are just another person that happened to be there when you were there, but it is more likely that they might be perceived to be, in recollection, the perpetrator because of having physically been there. Okay, more than if they hadn't been there. So if they hadn't been there, you're less likely to do that, even if they may be familiar from another circumstance. So in the case of one of the studies they did to explore this, participants watched a video of a staged shoplifting incident in a supermarket. So this was staged, okay? Two innocent people appear briefly shopping. One of those walks down the liquor aisle, disappears behind a stack of boxes. The perpetrator, who's a different person, emerges from behind the boxes and steals a bottle. Okay? It's giving an illusion of continuity between the first person going to a location and the second person appearing from the location, even though it's a different person. And what they thought was this expectation of continuity would play into this idea of the same identity more than the appearance of the people, the difference in the appearance. What they then did was showed the other person in another aisle, that is the pun that hadn't committed. The second innocent person, that is, who wasn't involved in this at all. More than half the participants didn't notice a change between the continuous innocent, i.e. the one from which whose actions the crime, the person committing the crime continued, and the perpetrator, i.e. a lot of them thought that person was the person that committed the crime, because they'd seen the move to the location and then someone's move out from it, they thought that was the person that committed it, even though they were two different people. Misidentification of one of them as the perpetrator was very high, 71 to 75%. However, those who did notice there had been a change were less likely to misidentify somebody. And noticing it could be perhaps a trigger to you that the representations, you know, will be of different people in the scene. Now, this is an experiment, but there is examples of where these things have happened in real life. You know, people have ended up in prison for many, many years on the basis of this sort of evidence. And the problem is, it's something people believe they do well, and they don't do as well as they think they do. So they talk about this as an example of unconscious transference. So you've got shallow or superficial processing where enough attention is not being given to the person to get a sense of familiarity. Sorry, you had enough attention that made you think the person was familiar, i.e. you saw them, you attended to them enough to recognize them, but not enough to encode that person specifically, for example, as being the perpetrator of the crime. So it is worrying that you may not always see that because people may appear in that context and you may not be attending sufficiently to them, you may then end up attribute to them what's actually being done by someone else in the similar context. You know, and that's, even though you may be quite convinced that you've seen somebody do something, it may not always be the case, which is rather worrying. Okay, and if you read the stuff in the memory text on this, there's a real interesting real-life example of a case where this happened and the person happened to be in the place but wasn't or had been seen in the place by the person on a different occasion or some other occasion and then was believed to be. And if you convict largely on the basis of eyewitness testimony, the problem is, if that's all you've got, it really may not be terribly reliable. but it talks about this in general. And it also talks about an interesting example of a guy who does research on this appearing on a chat show about it, right? So he's on the chat show and he's talking about this and how unreliable it is. He then gets picked up by the police. There's been actually a rape. The rape victim has identified him as the person who committed the crime. It happens. It's very clear he didn't, because he was on the chat show at the time with the, you know, the major police person in the area, various other people, you know, credible people could say he definitely wasn't there. It turned out that the person who had been raped was in a room where the program was on, where the TV was on, and he appeared. So he was seen by the rape victim at the time in which the crime happened, but he wasn't the perpetrator, but was misidentified by her as the perpetrator. So there was what we call there, again, the unconscious transference. Okay, so in his case, he was fine because he actually had very, very strong, you know, alibi and evidence, and ironically was an exact example of what he'd just been talking about. But obviously there may be other cases where, you know, things aren't as straightforward as that. Okay, so this is some of the readings. Again, I haven't updated the attention readings yet. Basically, the readings are the same. They will be the same this year as last year, except some things we've moved from sort of required down to recommended, whatever. But if you want to look more at these, that's the references for that. Okay, and I'll see some of you later this afternoon in your tutorials. Sorry? I can't hear you with the background noise there. Sorry. Yeah. No. It's actually, this is a really bad room here for the acoustics, that you get really, it's hard to hear anything outside of the general background noise. Yeah, I can hear something, but I can't work out what it is. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, we can't win on that one though. I mean, there are some people that need the slide, that need the slides for the purposes of they can't manage without it. So. Yeah.